rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, filling in this week and next also for Al Franken on Air America Radio. Greetings. Welcome to our program. Over 3 million manufacturing jobs have disappeared in the United States since 1998. Goldman Sachs estimates that 400,000 to 600,000 professional services and information sector jobs have moved overseas. The Economic Policy Institute finds U.S. software producing industries fell by 128,000 jobs. U.S. Department of Labor actually has a program where they can reimburse you if you got screwed because your job got moved overseas. Over 1,112,775 workers have gone through all the hassle and all the paperwork and actually proved that they got screwed by globalization. In the midst of this comes Jim Dorn from the Cato Institute, cato.org. Jim is Vice President of Academic Affairs at the Cato Institute and the recent author of an article, China, Constructive Partner or Emerging Threat. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great. Great to have you with us. You write about Hank Paulson, Henry Paulson going to China and this whole very, very high-level diplomatic group. I mean, about half of Bush's cabinet just went to China. In my opinion, and I'm guessing in your opinion, hat in hand. First of all, your take on that?
Yeah, it's unprecedented to have such a high-level delegation go to China, including the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, who usually doesn't get together that often with the Treasury people. But I think the most fundamental thing that they were looking for was basically to improve long-run relationships with China. But, of course, the U.S. Congress isn't looking at the long run. They're looking at the short run. They're worried about the trade deficit, which is growing and substantial. And
we're going to $800 billion this year.
And they're worried about, a number of other things with relations with China. So yeah. I think it was Paulson's taken a much different approach than previous people. He's looking at this long-run strategic economic engagement rather than short-run issues, which I think is actually a good thing to do with China. Again, I think with the new Congress coming in, there's going to be a lot of China bashing. They want a much quicker results than
Jim, I think the one thing that you and I can probably agree on this is that because of trade policies and because of the mind-bogglingly dumb debt policies, here we have this $8.5 trillion debt. China has so much of our debt that we basically have to kowtow to them. They have us in a position where they could do a lot of damage to the United States if either A, they just stopped buying our debt, or B, they started dumping it fast on international markets. Where we probably disagree is the statement that you make in this news release that you sent out. It says, any missteps that weaken the liberal global economic order and fuel economic nationalism will undermine a constructive U.S.-China policy of engagement. I agree it may undermine that policy, and China has the ability to do a lot of damage to us, but how do we save the middle class if we don't have some kind of economic nationalism? What's wrong with saying, yes, I want to protect the American workers, let's do away with these insane trade policies and go back to the kind of trade policies that this country had for 220 years that built the middle class?
Well, of course, you know, the Democratic Party for a long time were much more of a free trade party than the Republicans. So they've just changed, you know, in the recent future.
I'm not putting this forward as a partisan argument. I am neither a Democrat nor a Republican. I just think that it's nuts. I mean, here the first tariff laws in the United States were passed in 1789. And we had a tariff on nails and on metal products coming in the United States, and all of the federal government's revenue, I mean, all of the revenue that ran this government from 1789 until the Civil War came from tariffs. From the Civil War until World War I, it was two-thirds of our revenue. From World War I to World War II, it was a third of our revenue. And then Reagan, and then Bush, and then Clinton, and then Bush come along and say, we don't need those tariffs. We don't need to say, hey, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in America, and only 10 cents worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in China, you can, you know, it used to be you'd have to say there's a 90-cent tax when you bring that into the country. So it costs you a dollar dollar no matter where you make the shoes. So we continue to make shoes in America. Now, under what you describe as liberal, you know, economic policies, which is how Europeans correctly refer to them, here we call it globalization or internationalization, that equalizing tariff is gone, and American workers are competing with Chinese workers at a tenth of the price. How can you defend that?
Well, you know, we tried economic nationalism during the 1930s with the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which brought tariff levels to historically high levels, and we got the Great Depression out of it. So I don't think that's the answer.
Smoot-Hawley was passed 2 years after the Great Depression started. It was an attempt to mitigate the disaster of the Great Depression, and it was put forward by the Republican Herbert Hoover. It was passed in 1930, late 1930.
Yeah, well, the Depression, you know, lasted more than 1 year, up through 1929 to 33, and the tariff did not help international trade at all.
No, it absolutely didn't. Smoot-Hawley took international trade, the United States exports and imports, broadly, more than cut it in half. But the flip side of that, Jim Dorn, is that it dramatically increased internal production inside the United States. If we're not importing things, we have to make them.
Well, it didn't increase production much in the 1930s. The unemployment rate was historically high.
As a consequence of the Republican Great Depression.
Yeah, but the biggest failure besides the protectionism was the failure of the Federal Reserve, which let the money supply decrease by about a third between 1929 and 33. But in any event...
But Smoot-Hawley was not the only tariff that we've ever had. Smoot-Hawley was an increase in tariffs. We've had tariffs from the founding of this... We still have tariffs. I was looking yesterday at all of our tariffs. I mean, we still have... Bush is right now talking about dropping the tariffs on steel. Gee, we started a couple of years ago, 10 years ago, the steel industry was on the ropes. It was dying. Bill Clinton says, okay, we're going to put tariffs on steel. So now the Wall Street Journal on Friday, they had an article. He said, well, now, you know, the steel industry is strong, so let's get rid of the tariffs. What?
Well, you know, a tariff is simply a tax on imports, and it raises prices to U.S. consumers. So I don't think, you know, if we wanted to fund the federal government today by tariffs, we'd only be able to fund the federal government for a couple of weeks.
It only raises taxes on U.S. consumers to the extent that it all. Let me rephrase that. To the extent that it raises taxes on U.S. consumers, it also helps create good-paying jobs in the United States. I don't mind spending an extra buck for a pair of socks at Walmart if I know that somebody down the street from me, or me, if I need a job, can make 15 or 20 bucks an hour making socks at the textile mill down the street.
But you know, a lot of the products that we import from China are no longer even made in the United States.
That's my point.
And we'd simply import them from someplace else unless we put a cross-the-board tariff on every product coming in.
That's what we should do. That's what we did for 230 years, and it created the greatest industrial powerhouse in the world.
Well,
at what point are you guys going to say the last 30 years of taking apart a tariff-based international trade system and going to these, you know, GATT, NAFTA, WTO, CAFTA, all these things is a disaster and a failure? When are you going to acknowledge it? It's destroying the American middle class.
Well, you know, before 1929, the share of the federal government in our gross national product was less than 10%. In fact, total government was less than 10%. So if we went back to that type of government, less than 10%, and we used some tariffs, that would be a different thing. But
I'm not advocating tariffs as a way of funding the government. I'm advocating tariffs as a way of keeping production in the United States.
Well, China primarily.
That's why they were used.
China primarily is used as a processing center for manufacturers all over the world. And
right, but China protects their own domestic industry. If General Motors wants to sell a car in China, they have to pay a 20% import tariff into China. If China wants to sell a car in the United States, it's a 2% import tariff. What's wrong with that picture, and why do you guys support that kind of thing?
Well, of course, that hurts the Chinese consumers. It doesn't hurt U.S. consumers, and I'm against tariffs across the board. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to negotiate.
So if you get rid of all the tariffs across the board, that means that every country in that our workers in the United States are competing with 6 billion people in the world, half of whom make less than $2 a day. How can we possibly have a middle class on that basis?
Well, we're much more productive than those workers in the other countries. I mean, that's why U.S. workers are getting higher wages, because we're more productive, and employment's actually grown in the United States, and our manufacturing industry is probably the most productive in the world.
Wages have been stagnant ever since Reagan began his war on the middle class, Jim. You know that.
No, what I'm saying is the productivity growth in manufacturing has increased.
Sure, and that productivity has increased corporate profits, but it hasn't increased wages. Because we're competing with people in poor countries like China.
Well, my colleague Alan Reynolds has just done a book on this. This is a different question with respect to, you know, distribution of income and the increase in real wages in the United States. If you take into account not just wages but consumption, U.S. consumption has increased dramatically over the last 20 years or so.
Right, but we're doing it on debt. I mean, I would agree that that's a problem.
They're borrowing against their equity in their homes and the stock market and so forth.
Yeah. Jim Dorn, Jim, we have to wrap it up, but I appreciate you coming on the program and talking about this, and we'll have to do this again and get into a little more detail about China, which is where we intended to start, and I'm sorry
we're
off track. Cato.org, the website, you can read Jim's writing there. Jim Dorn, Vice President of Academic Affairs over at the Cato Institute. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman and the Al Franken Show. We'll be right back. Back defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to our program. Our number 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466. TomHartman.com, however you spell it, we'll get you into our live chat room if you'd like to drop in and hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire internet. What was that number, Alex says? 1-866-440-8466. Did I give it right? Yeah, I think so. Okay, there we go. Okay. And welcome back to our program. And by the way, Tom Hartman filling in for Al Franken this week and next week here on Air America Radio as well. So if you're hearing my voice and wondering, you know, what happened to Al, he's in Iraq right now. And good on him for it. Phyllis, driving in Mississippi. Hey, Phyllis, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I am great, but I'm going to get better. What's up?
Well, I was listening to that gentleman talk about economy and tariffs, and I wondered whether he lived in the same country as I live in, and whether he was actually living in La La Land, and whether they had looked forward, because it's been scaring me for quite a while that America, and I'm in my 60s, and things have changed radically. America is going to be getting to be a place where all people are going to be able to do is feed each other hamburgers, put each other up in hotels, have people gamble and take care of sick people, and even that is not going to happen because people are going to India for surgeries.
Yeah, we now have medical tourism is the new industry, and it's becoming $1 billion. They're projecting it to be a $1 billion industry by the end of the decade.
So how is it that America can survive if we don't produce anything?
We can't. We can't. What is happening is, starting with Reagan, maybe these guys had the very best of intentions. I'm willing to cut them some slack on that. I think that they drank the Kool-Aid and they actually believed it. You know, the Tom Friedmans of the world, the Ronald Reagans of the world, the Bill Clintons of the world, that they thought, you know, well, maybe if we just leave everything up to the big corporations and we create this international trade body, the World Trade Organization, we create like NAFTA, they have these Chapter 11 committees where corporations have sit on these committees to resolve disputes, and they have as much power as sovereign nations. If we just leave this up to multinational corporations, you know, it'll all work out and everything will be fine, and you know, free trade's a great idea. But the fact of the matter is that no country in the world that has maintained its economy over any period of time has done so by throwing open their borders and saying, yeah, sure, your corporations can do anything they want with anybody else in the world. Right to this day, Japan is protecting their economy. China is protecting their economy. South Korea is protecting their economy. I mean, virtually all of our trading partners are protecting their economies. The European nations that are experiencing some real crises right now are the ones who joined into the European trading bloc. I mean, they're starting to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should go back to having something, you know, something like tariffs with our borders. And the U.S. now, as a result of 26 years of this insane, voodoo economics, what George Herbert Walker Bush once referred to as voodoo economics. That was more the tax policy, but Reaganomics, this whole crazy thing, it's wiping us out. It is just plain old flat-out wiping us out. Phyllis, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Andy in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today, bud?
I'm great. What's up?
Merry Christmas to you, first of all.
Well, thank you. Merry Christmas to you, too, Andy.
Yeah, I just want to tell you, that guy's full of crap. You know, every time you get somebody on there about foreign trade, they try to defend it as, you know, how it costs us more money to buy something. Well, first of all, I don't know if you've been to Walmart or should I say Red China Mart. Every time you walk in there, what you're buying is just junk.
Yeah, well, you know, there's actually some good stuff made overseas, but that's not the point. The point, and you're right, I keep trying to find people to come on this program to defend international free trade. And I think this is one of the reasons why Friedman's books are so full of anecdotes, because you can always find some cute little anecdote that makes sense. But you look at the big picture, and the big picture is there's 6 billion people on the planet, half of whom are making less than $2 an hour, $2
right.
a day. And if, you know, if we're going to allow multinational corporations to say, okay, let's kick the doors open, you, Mr. and Mrs. American Worker, you get to compete with all these folks out here. Good luck.
Yeah.
What you are going to see is you know, we're going to have a nation, we're going to be a nation of, would you like fries with that? And even that is being outsourced.
Right. One other comment is he said something about how you said China has tariffs, and he said, well, that costs the Chinese more money. Well,
it's not. What it's doing is it's causing China now to build their own internal economic and industrial infrastructure. China is now producing stuff for their own markets.
So it's working. Yeah, it's working for them, but it's, you know, God forbid it works for us, right?
Exactly, and that's the point. Yeah, absolutely. Andy, thanks a lot.
You keep up the fight, Tom.
Yeah, well, you bet. We've been doing it here for 3.5 years. I'm not going to give up now. It's China and the U.S., by the way. This is from the Wall Street Journal. On Friday, China and the U.S. signed a multi-billion-dollar agreement with Westinghouse Electric to build nuclear power plants. Now, first of all, what's wrong with this picture? This is a deal that in part was funded by the U.S. Import-Export Bank, or at least it was originally set up to be. I don't know if they ended up doing that or not. I know Bernie Sanders is fighting that tooth and nail. So, number one. Number two, Westinghouse was bought out by a Japanese consortium led by Toshiba. And number three, why are we're transferring all this nuclear technology to China? It is like at every level, the story gets weirder and weirder. We'll be right back. 27 minutes past the hour.
So this is Christmas. And what have you done? Another year over. And so this is Christmas. I hope you have fun. The near and the dear ones, the old and the young.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 34 minutes past the hour. Filling in also this week and next for Al Franken, who is in Iraq on USO tour. Boy, speaking of Iraq, Matt Damon on Hardball. And Matt Damon suggesting, maybe this isn't such a good plan that we have this all-volunteer army, and among the volunteers, who is missing?
I don't think that it's fair, as I said before, that it seems like we have a fighting class in our country that's comprised of people who have to go for either financial reasons or, I don't think that is fair. And if you're going to send people to war, if we all get together and decide we need to go to war, then that needs to be shared by everybody, you know. And if the president has daughters who are of age, then maybe they should go too.
Yeah, Jenna and Barbara, off to Iraq with you. Well, in any case, Al's over there. Good on you. God bless you, Al, for keeping the morale of the troops up. China has managed, Robert Kuttner, writing in the Boston Globe last on Saturday, China has managed to combine something that in theory can't exist. And this is the problem with these right-wingers who think that democracy and capitalism are the same thing, who think that political systems and economic systems are the same thing. They're not. Just ask the Swedes, for example. China has managed to combine something that in theory can't exist, a Leninist one-party state and a fiercely efficient capitalist economy. And, it's rip-roaring along, and they have one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. They're putting people to death left and right. You speak out, you are toast. And that's where the stuff that we're buying for Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa gifts is coming from. And, oh, and Yule, blessed be. Anyhow, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 440-THOM. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room and hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire Internet, go to TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. And right up at the top, in the middle of the page, it says live chat. Just click right there, and it'll take you into the chat room. 1-866-440-8466. Vicki in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Hey, Vicki, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Boy, this is one subject that really gets my blood boiling. I was listening to C-SPAN yesterday, and there was a guy on from the, I think it was the International Economics Institute or something like that, and he said that free trade had added $1 trillion to our economy. But the fundamentally dishonest thing about that is that it's going to Bill Gates and the Waltons and George Soros and all of those.
Yeah, it'll grow an economy. It'll grow the wealth of the multinational corporations. It destroys the middle class. And ultimately, if you want to have a democracy, a functional democracy, you must have a middle class.
Right. Well, and that was going to be my point, is that what this is going to lead to is a centrally planned economy. And all of...
Well, that's what we're having right now. It's being planned by big multinational corporations. 52 of the 100 largest economies in the world are corporations, not countries.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're just making money hand over fist.
You know what's incredible, Vicki, is you've got all these right-wingers who for years and years, I remember back when I was a kid, back in the 60s, when I was a teenager, when I was 13, in 1964, I went door-to-door for Barry Goldwater. My dad was the Republican County, you know, guy, and a friend of my dad's took me to a John Birch Society meeting when I was 13. You know, 3 years later, I was out, you know, in East Lansing in the anti-war protests and in SDS, but there it was, and they were all hysterical about the UN, the loss of sovereignty. We're surrendering sovereignty to the UN. Well, we've surrendered sovereignty to the World Trade Organization. I mean,
absolutely, yeah. And if you go back and look in the congressional record, when they were debating it, they said it. The senators said that this is going to cause us a loss of sovereignty. And because the trade disputes, they're settled by a tribunal, and they can impose fines on us for our laws, and those fines then turn into taxes. So, I mean, we basically turned over our country to corporations.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep, well said, Vicki. Thank you very much. Sheldon in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Sheldon.
Hey, Tom. There's an elephant in the room that I'd like you to introduce when you have these guys from Cato or Ayn Rand come on, which is carbon. If we truly took that cost into account, wouldn't it be cheaper for me to have a product shipped to Seattle from Idaho or Montana than from all the way in Bangladesh or China?
Yeah, the actual cost of a gallon of gasoline, for example, is around $10. When you consider all of the what are called externalities, all of the other costs associated with it, the people who get cancer from the fumes, the cost to the world of the carbon that's being put into the atmosphere in terms of global warming, when you add up all those costs, and this is of course, the corporate imperative is to internalize profits and externalize the costs and dump those costs on us. It's what Walmart does, and not just Walmart, not to pick on them, because what they're doing is perfectly legal. This is how the system is rigged, and the tragedy thereof is dumping on you and me the cost of health care, for example, and primary school, preschool education and post-school education and all these other services that have to be provided to people who are living below the poverty line, who are working at Walmart or just in general at minimum wage jobs all across the United States.
I understand, Tom. My bigger concern is that all of our conversations have become econocentric, not ecologically centric, and I would like for that to be, I just was hoping to use this as a brief platform, you know, to just say we need to introduce that into the conversation.
Yes. And let me add to that, as you might have heard me mention last week, the weekend before last, I spent the weekend in San Francisco at the Praxis Peace Conference, which was a closed-door kind of think tank meeting of about 30 of us. And the issue of the weekend was the fact that the best projection, Stuart Pym, in fact, is going to be on the program this week talking about it. He was there at the conference along with George Lakoff and a few other folks. And Stuart Pym pointed out that sometime within the next 35 years, half of all the species on Earth will be gone. And as a consequence of these kinds of behaviors of ours, we need to be paying attention to that. We're gonna take a break just for a minute from this topic because we've got Al Franken on the line from Baghdad. Hey, Al Franken.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I am great. How is Baghdad? How's the USO tour going?
Well, it's a lot of fun, as usual. This is our fourth year doing it in Kuwait and Afghanistan, Iraq, and we're in Iraq now. And it's been a really, really interesting tour, as usual. I'm doing shows and meet and greets with troops. And today we did some meet and greets at some border operating bases. And one of the things I say is that one thing that Americans, the only thing we agree on, we learned from Vietnam, is to respect the troops.
Yeah.
One of the things I can do when I'm doing just a meet and greet, not a show, because the show is like very Bob Hope-y kind of show. We have the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders. And we have some country western music artists like Dale Worley and Mark Will, and some other music, and the Army Band, and I do stand up and stuff like that. And when I just talk to the troops, I make sure to let them know that Americans support them, the troops.
Right, regardless of political persuasion.
Exactly, but also we eat lunch and dinner and breakfast in the dining facilities, and so I've been talking to a lot of groups, and it's very, very interesting. A great majority, I'd say majority of the groups don't really focus very much on the macro policy of the war, but are really concerned with their task at hand. But this year, I'd say I've gotten in more discussions about the state of the war, and the people who have jobs like training the Iraqi military or a State Department guy who is working with a professional reconstruction. Or an interrogator. They tend to be much more thoughtful, obviously, about the whole thing.
And you're getting some good, interesting feedback.
And fairly pessimistic.
Oh, interesting. Because we're doing the show together, we've got a hard break coming up in 20 seconds. So just a quick wrap from you, if you'd like.
Let's stay after the hard break if we could. There's no quick graph other than this is all very complex. The guy training the Iraqi army is very pessimistic because they're so corrupt.
Yeah.
And we'll talk more about some of the other people.
Okay, we'll do it. We'll do it next time. Al Franken, thanks, doing the USO tour. They're in Iraq, and man, what a marvelous service to your country that you're doing, Al. Thank you so much. It's Tom Hartman filling in for Al Franken and doing my program as well. 45 minutes past the hour.
I'm vet with a cardboard sign, sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing, both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore.
And welcome back, 9.5 minutes past the hour, or before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, filling in for Al Franken, and also doing my own show. So we're doing two at once. This has got to be a first. In progressive talk radio. Welcome back to the program. Al Franken on the line with us live from Baghdad. Al, you were telling us just before we went to the break that you're sensing a difference in the perspective of the people, that the many of the people that you're talking with there, in particular the Iraqis. You want to elaborate on that?
Well, I'm not sure how good this phone connection is. Not from the Iraqis. I haven't been talking to Iraqis. I've been talking to American troops. And I wouldn't overgeneralize from conversations I'm having. One, it's not a large sample. And two, again, I'd say that most of the troops really focused on the task that they just have before them and are doing their jobs as best as they can.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who seem to be most thoughtful about the war are seem more. I'll give you an example. I talked to an interpreter who's an American. He's a contractor. He's an American Egyptian, and he's been here for 2.5 years. And he just made, he took the third 11 approach, which is that if you let the Iraqis know that this is an open-ended commitment by us, they'll never get it together.
Mm.
The government will never do the hard work it needs to do.
In other words, he's asking for a timeline.
He was very convincing when he needed to pull out. And there'll be a guy who I talked to who is a JAG officer who's working with the local, this is up in Mosul, working with the local, judicial system, and is actually impressed with the judges up there.
Yeah.
And who were experienced, not Baptists. And he was a guy who actually listened to my show all the time when he was back in the States. And very much believes the war was a mistake, but since we need to stay longer. So there's all different,
Al, I'm curious. Yeah, there's a spectrum of opinion there. Here in the United States, one of the big speculations has right now, particularly over the last week. Yeah, you were gone last week as well in Afghanistan, as I recall, and several of the other Gulf countries.
Last week I was in Kuwait.
And now you're in Iraq. But during that week, there was a lot of speculation in the press and certainly on this network about the Cheney's visit to Saudi Arabia, the story in the New York Times, that basically the Saudis are saying, we're going to protect the Sunnis in Iraq no matter what. If you guys pull out, we're moving in, and then you're going to have a region-wide war. It's a World War I scenario where our pulling out could be the Archduke Ferdinand moment. On the other hand, our getting in may well have been it, and it may already be beyond stopping. There's a question about, are we dancing to the Saudis' tune, or are they dancing to our tune, or is there this huge dissension going on inside Saudi Arabia with factions emerging about how the Sunni problem should be handled? Any discussion of that going on in Iraq?
No, not really. I think most of the focus is really more on the relationship with the Iraqi people and with the Iraqi government and the Iraqi institutions, like the military, like the police. I mean, it's pretty widely known that the police are worse than the army. The guys I talked to who train the Iraq army are very, very pessimistic about the Iraq army's ability to do its job because of corruption mainly.
Right.
And so they and also that guys just take off whenever they want to. In the Iraq military, you can actually just leave. You don't have to, there's no such thing as AWOL, you just leave. And so that's why when we side with the Iraqis.
So being in the Iraq Army is sort of a part-time job if you want it to be.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
So,
and I hope this something okay. I remember the years I've used a satellite phone, which I have here, just isn't working. I sound drunk.
Yeah,
because it's very slurred.
It does sound pretty. It does sound pretty bad, but we're assuming that you're okay.
Yes,
you sound fine. Yeah, the phone sounds terrible.
Well, actually, ironically, this is like the last place to be drunk. But you can't drink here.
Yeah.
There's no drink here.
Yeah.
But that didn't matter. I guess the satellite phone sounded like slurring. And I was told your producer sounded a little robotic here. So anyway, I hope you can hear me okay. I'll tell you a little bit about some, we had a real bad thing happen on the show, during the, USO show. There was a people might come on as Saddam Hussein. And this year I'm doing the new Saddam, the trial Saddam with the beard and the white suit, dark suit and the white shirt. And in Mosul, there was an Iraqi citizen.
I'm sorry, we have to wrap it up. I know you're having a hard time hearing the cues in the background there, but we're just slammed out of time at the top of the hour. We've got Robert Fisk coming up next. So thanks so much for showing up on your own show. It's Al Franken, live from Baghdad.
Yes, sir. Okay, all right, bye-bye.
Okay. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here filling in for Al Franken and, of course, doing my own radio program on Air America Radio. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Franken Show with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, filling in this week and next also for the Al Franken Show on Air America Radio. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. Is the American Empire falling? Robert Fisk has been writing about this recently. We will be getting into that a little later on in the program. But to what extent is the end of the American, or should we ever have considered it empire? I mean, is that where we went wrong? The point at which we started thinking, okay, we are an empire. You know, this I Claudius moment. How do we take this forward? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Charlie in Brooklyn, I know you wanted to comment in the last hour there before as we were getting into these issues. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's so great to hear you on in the air in New York again. We miss you.
Thank you.
I wonder if you happened to catch yesterday's Tim Russert's Republican right-wing roundup. After a half hour of Newt Gingrich verbal flatulence, he introduced the chowderhead corner, David Brooks and Tom Friedman.
I know, the right and the Reich.
Right. And, you know, the columnists, the dunderheads, former war cheerleaders, it was notable to hear Friedman yesterday get up on his hind legs for a change after, I think it was at Rumsfeld's farewell ceremony that Dick Cheney called him the greatest Secretary of Defense we've ever had in the country.
Yeah, which means one of two things. Either Cheney is lying through his teeth because they just fired the guy, or Bush just made the greatest strategic error, the greatest management error in the history of the United States in firing the guy who's the most brilliant Secretary of Defense since the Washington administration.
Absolutely. It revives the old debate. Are they lying or just stupid? But I guess the answer is really both. Not mutually exclusive.
Well said, Charlie. Absolutely. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Andre.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, love your show.
Thank you.
I'm an activist here in South Carolina, and like yourself, I don't consider myself a Republican or a Democrat. But I did vote for the Democrats and put them in office. And I really feel as though they've just left us on the side of the road, you know. I went to Washington in March to impeach George Bush and end the war.
Mm.
And it appears to me that every time I turn on the television, they're either trying to sell me a new candidate or they're redirecting the question with the Hamilton Baker fiasco.
Yeah.
How can we redirect this back?
Two thoughts on this. Andre, you raise a couple of really, really good points, and I appreciate your calling in and raising them. The first is, how do you go about impeaching Bush? And I think that John Dean has made a very, very cogent argument over at FindLaw, where he does a lot of his writing. He says that really what we should do, you know, the Constitution calls for impeachment of any federal officer, anybody who is a federal officer. And so why not start with some of the people around Bush? Why not start with, you know, like Elliot Abrams? Why not start with some of the folks working in the Pentagon? There's a whole bunch of folks in the cabinet. I mean, how about impeaching Connally's arrest? It could be several levels below that. We don't need to start with Bush and Cheney, number one. That would kind of bring the issue up. Number two, the Democrats, of course, to say, oh, I'm going to impeach Bush right now, it would be politically stupid, and it would be legally stupid. It's just like, you know, when you arrest somebody, it would be inappropriate for the prosecutor to go on TV and say, okay, we just arrested Joe Blow, and I'm going to see to it that he gets the death penalty because this guy is guilty. No, the prosecutor should go on TV and say, we just arrested Joe Blow because we have some evidence that indicates that he may be guilty, or going to put it before a judge and jury. We have the presumption of innocence in the United States. So first you have to gather the evidence. So this is where we have to hold the Democrats' feet to the fire, is not please impeach, but rather please investigate. Because if the investigations happen, the crimes will become obvious. When the crimes are obvious, then the impeachment is going to be hard to stop, number one. Number two, the perhaps larger issue you raise is, you know, what about the Democratic Party? What about the fact that you've got so many, for lack of a better word, corporatists inside the Democratic Party, Republican light? You know, it was a Harry Truman's old saying, you know, if an American is given a choice between voting for a Republican or a Democrat who behaves like a Republican, he'll choose the Republican every time. Now, Harry Truman was not pro-Republican. His point was that the Democrats need to behave like Democrats rather than like Republicans. But we've got a bunch of people in the Democratic Party who are behaving like Republicans and who have basically sold out to the big corporate interests and who are increasingly becoming corporatists. And a lot of folks are sitting around going, well, the solution is to just elect the right people. We just have to elect the good guys. We just got to find the good people. Wouldn't it be great if Russ Feingold was president? Wouldn't it be great if Barbara Boxer was president? We just need Howard Dean as president. John Edwards, he'd do a great job. Let's get Ralph Nader in there. The list goes on and on, right? Well, all of that is fine, but I've got to say, in the United States, we don't elect leaders. We elect representatives. This is, by the way, a lesson that, you know, obviously has been completely lost on George W. Bush. You know, as
if this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Well, apparently he thinks it is. But, you know, setting aside and another impeachable offense, frankly, in my opinion, but setting aside the inanity of that perspective, the point is that it's not about who's in office. It's about us. It's about you and me. If you look at the history of this country and you look at the history of every significant change in this country, whether it was the ending of slavery, whether it was the abolition of legal apartheid in the United States, the civil rights movement, whether it was the suffrage movement to give rights to women, whatever it may be, I mean, and there have been a number of, you know, the movements for the rights of disabled persons in this country, the gay rights movement that has been slowly moving along. As if you look at the history of any of the movements for social progress and positive, healthy change in the United States, none of them started from the top down. Not a single one. Even the American Revolution didn't start from the top down. The top of the American government at the time of the American Revolution were the loyalists, who were loyal to King George. I mean, you know, Ben Franklin getting in a battle with his grandson about this, or his son about this. So the point is, it's about us. We have to create the parade. If we create a big enough parade and enough of us are out there marching down the streets, and I don't mean that literally, although there is a literal component to it. If there are enough of us speaking out, if our elected representatives are hearing from us all the time, if they're seeing letters that we write to the editor of the newspaper all the time, if they're seeing op-ed pieces that we put on websites all over the place, if they hear from us, then they will say, hey, this is a pretty cool parade. I think I'll hoist my flag and get in front of this parade. I think it's really important to remember that Teddy Roosevelt, you can even go back before that, Abraham Lincoln was not elected on a platform of abolishing slavery. Go back and read the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He was talking about, yeah, there's an irreconcilable difference between whites and blacks. He was not elected on a platform of abolishing slavery. But when the parade got so big, he said, okay, this is the direction we're going to go. Teddy Roosevelt was not elected on a platform of busting up big corporations. He was elected vice president in the McKinley administration as a rich, white, pro-business, the hero of San Juan Hill, kind of a macho guy, but that was it. Franklin Roosevelt was not elected as a guy who was going to go in and take down corporate power in the United States. Franklin Roosevelt was elected on a very modest platform. Herbert Hoover in 1932, the 32 election, Hoover, the Republican, we were in the midst of the Republican Great Depression, and Hoover's platform was prosperity is just around the corner. And Roosevelt's platform was essentially, let's not make radical change. We're gonna. In fact, the phrase New Deal, he wrote into a speech just right around the time he was elected, off the top of his head. I mean, he just threw it in. So what happened was, in every one of these cases, Lyndon Johnson, civil rights, here's a guy who was anti-civil rights, essentially, when he was in Texas. I mean, he was just a good old boy in Texas, and became, passing the civil rights legislation in the 60s. In every case, politicians moved because we the people spoke out. And it's not just politicians. Look at the Supreme Court with Roe v. Wade. Or on the bad side, Plessy versus Ferguson in 1898. In every case, you see the court moving, you see Congress moving, you see presidents moving, because we the people are speaking out. And so that's where we need to be focusing our attention, is building the parade, building the movement, getting people out there, getting people active, getting people mobilized, getting people passionate, getting people informed. And the politicians will follow. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Now, more of the Al Franken Show with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman here with you, filling in for Al Franken, and of course doing the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour, listener-supported radio. That's right, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors and our affiliated stations. Listen carefully for local advertisements. Support your local advertisers. Let them know that you're listening. Buy their products. And also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. SacredGroundsCoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now. SmallDog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. And Shirley in New York City. Hey, Shirley, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. I'm so happy to hear from you again in New York.
Well, thank you, Shirley.
I miss you.
Thank you.
My question is this. When Bush and Cheney both took that oath of office for this photo op when they became vice president and president, when they go before Congress, why do they have to swear in again? Shouldn't that one oath be sufficient?
Well, I think the reason that they have to swear in again is because they're swearing to tell the truth, whereas the oath of office says that the president, I've got it here someplace, the president, it's the executive branch. Here it is. The president shall... No, that's not it either. Oh, here it is. Before he shall enter the execution of the office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. This is what the president swears to, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability... Now, notice, Shirley, that it doesn't... I'm pausing here. Notice that it is not about to say, protect America, protect Americans, stop terrorists, anything like that. You know, George keeps saying, my job is... Okay. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Period. End of quote. End of sentence. End of paragraph. End of clause. So the only thing that he swears to do... as his job description is to protect the Constitution. And I would say that that's a very strong grounds for impeachment, because that he's absolutely failed in that regard. He's violating the First Amendment, our right to free expression with his free speech zones. He's violating the Fourth Amendment with his wiretapping on Americans without warrants. He's violating the Fifth Amendment. Right on down the list. So, but the reason why, for example, when he went before the 9/11 Commission and he refused to allow himself to be sworn to tell the truth,
right,
and Dick Cheney had to go with him, and they had to have rules where if any time that Bush is talking, Cheney can't be requested to be drinking water, stuff like that. I'm just kidding. Was because
probably was tapping his foot underneath the table.
There you go. It was because, you know, swearing to tell the truth, putting a person under oath in a court of law in a legal sense is different than an oath of office, but arguably it should suffice. You know, you're right. I think in the big principle, you're absolutely right. So, well said. Thank you very much, Shirley.
Okay, and great to hear from you again. Don't be gone so long.
Okay, thanks a lot, Shirley. Good talking with you. Keith in Huntington, California. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Great, what's up?
You were talking earlier about these free trade agreements and all that, you know, all this globalization movement. I think it's ironic, actually, that we're told that that's like the ideal of democracy when all these trade secrets, all these agreements are made in secret, and they're completely anti-democratic.
Yeah.
Internally, they actually state that, and, you know, and yet people that fight them are actually portrayed as socialists.
Well, what's
interesting, when they actually implement those policies, we're getting the biggest benefit from the most corrupt governments there are.
Yeah, and what's interesting is when you ask the guys who are the real thinkers behind the thinkers, you know, we have on this program probably every other week or so somebody from the Ayn Rand Institute, the original objectivists, the organization into which Alan Greenspan was inducted in Ayn Rand's apartment back in 1956, and they're the folks whose thinking has been adopted by the libertarians and adopted by the Grover Norquist branch of the Republican Party. And they will tell you right up front, and they do regularly on this program, we don't believe in democracy. We think that that's mob rule. We're opposed to democracy. We're in favor of capitalism and free enterprise as a governing system. And my response to that, of course, is that capitalism and free enterprise are fine things, and I'm all in favor of them, but they're not governing systems, they're economic systems. And an economic system must be subordinate to a political system, not the other way around. And that's the problem, is that all these cons, what they're suggesting is that the political system should be subordinate to the economic system. And you know, here in the United States or anywhere else in the world, most of your European countries, certainly all of the northern European countries, are saying, no, sorry, the economic system is going to be subordinate to the will of the people. And so we're going to have strong unions. We're going to have strong workplace protections. We're going to have strong environmental protections. We're going to have national health care. And, you know, whether it's free market or not. And in those countries where we say, hey, make the market totally free, we used to call those countries banana republics. I mean, we would go in and, you know, take them over. We run the agriculture or business in Nicaragua and take the pineapples out of Hawaii before we incorporated them with statehood. And I mean, just it's imperialist, really, essentially. Keith, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, actually, we'd settle for a clean election, you know, but it's a start. And also filling in for Al Franken here on Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
Radio.
with Tom Hartman on the Al Franken Show.
Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war.
Welcome back to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman program also filling in for the Al Franken Show today as well. The transformation, writes Jason Dean in today's Wall Street Journal, his Outlook column. The transformation of Chinese society. Actually, let me start at the beginning. China's embrace of market forces in the past three decades has virtually reshaped every aspect of its people's lives, writes Jason Dean. He says that transformation has also wiped out much of a cradle-to-grave safety net, healthcare, education, pensions, that ensured basic needs were met for most of the population. It has severely damaged large parts of the country's environment and triggered a widening gap between rich and poor. And then they've got an inequality chart. Japan is 24.9 on a scale of 0 to 100. 100 is total inequality. You've got, you know, one person who owns virtually everything and one person who owns nothing, and everybody in between has nothing. You know, that would be 100%. And 0 would be everybody has exactly the same. Japan is 24.9. The U.S. is 40.8. China is 44.7. Pretty bad. Now, I remember back in 1986, in November of 1986, I spent the month of November in China, in Beijing, at the Beijing International Acupuncture Hospital, learning acupuncture. I was curious. I was on my way to the Philippines on business, and they were running this program. It was really cheap. It was like $130 a week, which included room and board. This was before Tiananmen Square. This was before the industrialization of China. You could stand in Tiananmen Square. I did stand on that square. There's this huge eight-lane street there, and once every 4 or 5 minutes, one car would go by. But there was an ocean of black bicycles constantly moving around the city. Everybody was heating with coal. There were every little alleyway, there were these piles of coal bricks, and people would just heat one room in their house. I mean, it was just a very, very different China than the China that we have today. And working in that hospital, anybody could come into that hospital and get treated, and did. I mean, people would just walk in, and we would treat them. It's very different now. This is what Jason Dean is writing in today's Wall Street Journal. He said, indeed, while China's government still calls its system socialist and still plays a big role in the economy, what has developed here sometimes resembles a sort of naked capitalism where an unfettered pursuit of profit governs almost all facets of life, and a growing share of the population is left unprotected. Some nominally public schools charge prohibitively steep tuition. State-owned companies are among the biggest polluters. From Shenzhen in the south to Beijing in the north, and often in defiance of party edicts, developers with close ties to local governments are covering cities with luxury real estate developments, even as housing prices soar to levels where urban Chinese can't afford. Meanwhile, underfunded government hospitals turn away patients who can't afford cash up front for treatment. State-run tobacco companies keen for profit peddle trillions of cigarettes a year, though smoking-related diseases and health care costs continue to soar. It's interesting. No longer able to rely on state health or pension programs, many Chinese citizens are banking large chunks of their income to pay their own way. And he wraps this thing up. He says, a nation that started out railing against capitalism now embodies many of its most extreme elements. Like other industrializing countries, it must find ways to guide national ambitions so they don't ultimately undercut the national interest. And there's where we're at. We're doing the same thing China's doing. It demonstrates that you can have a wide-open free capitalist market in a dictatorship. People say, oh, America will never move toward a dictatorship. We have a free market. I'm sorry, have you talked to George Bush recently? Or have you visited China recently? Mark in Sonoma County, California. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey there. I was driving home at the top of your show, and I often manage to catch your interviews with the various, what shall we call them, corporatists, reactionaries. I'm impressed with how, you know, civil you are with them, how you give them their space and you let them speak. But usually they're ready to spar with you a little. They know where you're going, and maybe they don't want you to go there. But I don't mean to be disrespectful with someone who, you know, doubtless is far more credentialed than I am, but he didn't seem to even understand what you were saying.
I was frankly surprised. Mark, I was expecting at least a Tom Friedman defense of free markets.
Well, yes, and I wonder what's going on here. It ties together the things you've been talking about all
but,
day.
But here, in his defense, we had originally booked him on the topic. He wrote this op-ed saying, you know, China is not our enemy, and we need to stop demonizing China. And, you know, communist China, and they're going to nuke us, and they're building a military and all this stuff because they're a trading partner. And I think that that's what he was expecting to talk about. And frankly, that's where I expected to start the conversation.
We were talking about very fundamental things, you know. And if I don't have time to, you know, talk about my relationship with economics and so on, or where I come from on those things. But, you know, this is very basic stuff. And he shouldn't have been so off balance, and I have to wonder whether what's going on is that our ruling class is so used to ruling
and not being questioned.
Unquestioned. It's been going on a long time, but, you know, I would argue with you, you seem to imply sometimes that we've had golden ages where the people actually ruled. I would say that at best, in our best times in our history, we've managed to make ourselves heard and somewhat respected. And that's what democracy is all about. It's not about necessarily putting a genius in charge. It's about everybody's voice being heard, everybody's interests being respected. And we've managed from time to time to get that, but we've always had an economic ruling class. We've always been fundamentally a nation run by our business people.
But there have been these cycles, and they're clearly identifiable cycles.
Oh, I know that.
Where by and large, the interests of the average person were, at least in the public mind and in public dialogue, put first on the one hand, or where by and large, the interests of the economic royalists, as Franklin Roosevelt.
Oh, yes, but it's a cycle more or less. The royalism phases are, I think, you know, like the one we're in now, are the ones where they get so arrogant that they don't even seem to understand.
Yeah, I get it, Mark, and I agree with you. And these guys. Thank you for the call. And these guys know that on most shows they would never be asked, not to speak of the particular guests that we had. I mean, you know, God bless them for coming on the program. It's hard enough to find conservatives who are willing to come on and debate. I mean, anybody. You know, they want to go on shows where they know that they're going to be safely asked reasonable questions, what they think are reasonable questions, and nobody's going to do a follow-up, and, you know, the Tim Russert kind of interviews. And anyhow, Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom, you know, that Cato guest, there was a guy like him on Lou Dobbs, and his view was, this goes right in, free democratic France with regulated markets was more tyrannical than laissez-faire China with an autocratic government. Can you believe it?
See? Well, yeah, I do believe it, because they believe that the economic system is the governing system, and it's not.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, the last couple of weeks, I've been over at this crazy conservative website called townhall.com.
Oh, yeah. My God, Buckley's site.
It was like entering some bizarre twilight zone. You got screen names like John Galt, who's a character of Ayn Rand, right?
Yeah, yeah, and Alice Shrugged.
Yeah, and so I copied and pasted and put credit to you on one of your two-year-old articles called Democracy, Not Free Markets, Will Save the Middle Class, right?
Mm-hmm.
I get responses coming at me, you commie pinko, since when is we the people democracy? These guys do not understand. They think capitalism is democracy.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Tom. Yeah. And they're absolutely wrong. And you make your point very well, and I appreciate it. Virginia in Belen, New Mexico. Hey, Virginia.
Oh, hi. I was just calling about the global plantation and another industry I think we're losing, and that kind of fits in with the guy that was talking about the ecological impact. And repair people. No, you know, cheap, easy credit and Madison Avenue and everything.
Oh, you mean another industry we're losing is the repair industry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first business I ever started when I was in college.
Throws everything away. The landfills are filling up with everything. And, I mean, nobody gets anything fixed anymore.
Yep, you're absolutely right. When I was and thank you, Virginia, for that. When I was 18, 19 years old, we started a business that was a TV repair and stereo repair shop in the back of a head shop, and grew it to a company with 6 employees, and it was doing quite well, actually. This is back in the late 60s. Anyhow, we're going to do the Tom Hartman Program Progressive Pop Quiz right now. Our question, actor Matt Damon said on the Hardball College Tour, the President Bush should consider sending whom to Iraq? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The answer coming up after the break. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 45 minutes past the hour. Fill in and also here for Al Franken on Air America Radio today. This week. Next week, too.
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey!
Chicken hawks. Chicken hawks. Chicken hawks. Chicken hawks. Dick Cheney, he didn't serve. Tom DeLay, he didn't serve. And George Bush was A-W-O-L. Chicken hawks.
And welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program. And also Air America running our show to filling in for Al Franken this week and next as he's in Iraq on his USO tour. 9 minutes before the hour, we have a winner, our progressive pop quiz. Once again, our question was, actor Matt Damon said on the Hardball College Tour that President Bush should consider sending whom to Iraq. And congratulations to Jeff Richardson in Tacoma, Washington. That's Jeff in Tacoma, frequent caller to the program. And Jeff knew that the correct answer is, well, here it is in Matt Damon's own words.
The president has daughters who are of age, and maybe they should go too.
The president has daughters of age. Maybe they should go, too, he said. Yeah. So Jenna and Barbara, or the Bush twins, or however you wanted to say it, congratulations, Jeff. He wins a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It.
Get Screwed by Tom Hartman.
Yes. Thank you, Alex. It's from the ad for the book, yes. Victoria Jones, our senior Colin Powell correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, indeed, Colin Powell was a matter of great discussion at this morning's gaggle, and again at this afternoon's briefing, well, partly because I kept bringing him up, but others were asking questions about him as well. Question being, wasn't the administration trying to give the impression that he was on the same page as them, which is exactly what was happening during the gaggle?
Now, if I for our listeners who may not be familiar with what you're talking about, I have a 20-second clip of Colin Powell.
That's wonderful.
This is the one you're talking about. Here it is.
With the assessment of Mr. Baker and Mr. Hamilton, it's grave and deteriorating. And as Secretary Designate of Defense Bob Gates said at his confirmation hearing, we're not winning. So it's grave and deteriorating, and we're not winning. We are losing. We haven't lost. And this is the time now to start to put in place the kinds of strategies that will turn this situation around.
So we are losing. Not words that the Bushies wanted to hear.
No, they didn't want to hear those words. Very early on in the morning gaggle, in fact, Tony Snow said that he did not say that. And then the entire
You said that Colin Powell didn't say that?
That's what he said at first. Then the whole press corps said, oh, yes, he did. And then Snow looked down at his transcript.
Oh, wait a minute. This isn't Fox News. I can't just make stuff up.
Yes, he did say it. And in the afternoon briefing, he absolutely concurred that he did say it and agrees that he did say Civil War and agrees that he said everything that he did say. But nevertheless, great deference being given, kid gloves, I would say, being given to Colin Powell.
Yeah. Interesting. Why?
I think because Colin Powell's remarkably popular, and when your approval rating of handling of the war is down now at 28%, according to a CNN poll, you don't want to tick any more people off.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, you know, Chuck Hagel came out and spoke against this, the former president of what is now ESNS Voting Machine Company, now the Republican senator from Nebraska. They didn't go after him. I mean, there have been a number of Republicans who've spoken out, essentially, against the war, and the Bushies just kind of ignore it.
Right, exactly. But on the other hand, you know, they did not agree with him. He was pushed as to say, well, do you agree that we're losing?
Yeah.
And not surprisingly, he would not agree with that.
Yeah. I'm curious what your take is, Victoria Jones, on the trip of several members of the president's cabinet, plus Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, plus Mr. Paulson, the secretary of the Treasury, to China to apparently... you know, bow and scrape at the altar of the Chinese.
To be honest with you, I have not followed it closely. I don't have very much of a take on it.
There's not much buzz in Washington, D.C. about this?
No, there really isn't. There's more buzz about the Indian-American Nuclear Act that was signed this morning.
Well, that's another interesting one. We're getting mangoes from India. We're going to give them nuclear technology. They're refusing to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We're threatening to attack Iran, which has actually signed the treaty and said, yes, we'll allow inspectors in. India won't sign the treaty. What's wrong with this picture?
We believe that this ends their isolation. We think that this is good for
trade.
Let's
just give them the bomb.
We think that this is good for trade. We think this is good for everybody. We think that this is good for American business because we can now trade with them. We can trade in nuclear energy products.
Yeah, well, and the other story in today's paper is how we're selling nuclear technology now to China as well. Westinghouse was bought by Toshiba, by a Japanese company. But a Japanese company operating in America that most people think of as an American company has got a multi-billion dollar contract now to sell nuclear power technology to the communist Chinese.
Very interesting.
Yeah, several new reactors. It was in today's Wall Street Journal, as I recall. And you know, nobody, not even a hiccup. You know, nobody's looking at this like, hey, wait a minute. Is this a good idea? Should we be doing this? Blowback about the Indian program, you can understand because the Indians won't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and they're building nuclear weapons. And they're now going to be able to use their existing... But India's at least a democracy. I mean, China doesn't even pretend to be a democracy.
No, it doesn't tend to be whatsoever. And I think that is one of the reasons why the Indian thing is going forward. They do act like a democracy.
Yeah. Well, they in fact are a democracy. It's just we may not, you know, agree with everything they do and are doing. But China, wow, incredible. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Where are we going to go with this thing? How is the capitalist transformation of China affecting us? What's the larger question? What's the future of America? What about the economic royalists? What are the cycles that we've seen in the United States of the people taking over versus the corporations taking over? What does, for example, Hillary or Obama represent in the evolution of that cycle? I'm talking about that stuff after the news at the top of the hour. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, filling in for Al Franken as well.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Yeah, and every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Tom Hartman here with you. noon to 3 Eastern Time, 9 to noon Pacific Time. Been doing this program for 3.5 years right here on this day part, and pleased to continue doing so. Also filling in for Al Franken today on the Air America Radio Network, which also syndicates my normal program, which is what you're hearing right now. Interesting, the Lieberman maneuver here, Joe Connison over at Salon.com. This is kind of not apropos of our discussion, but just let me just drop this into the water and see what kind of ripples it produces. What would happen if George W. Bush, now that Bolton has bolted from the United Nations or has been pushed out, or, you know, Bush got it, Bolton got it, that the Democrats aren't going to anoint him. So what if Bush were to say to Joe Lieberman, hey, how'd you like to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations? And Lieberman said, cool, I'll do that. Now, Connecticut has a Republican governor, so that would mean that the Senate would become Republican, because presumably the Republican governor from Connecticut would appoint a Republican to replace Lieberman. Could it be? Are we getting too Machiavellian here? Or is that the ultimate rove tactic? Who knows? I don't know. But anyway, I thought I'd just toss that. I thought that was an interesting, Joe Connison, interesting and insightful thought. 31,709 earmarks later, Bush decides pork is a problem. That's the headline over at thinkprogress.org. In 2006, Congress allocated a record $71.77 billion to 15,832 special projects. This is more than double the amount of pork spent in 1994. There's only 4,000 pork barrel projects back then, 15,000 this year. So George W. Bush has finally decided that maybe this is a problem we need to address. Now that the Democrats have already said this is going to be one of the first things we're going to address, Bush is like, well, okay. See, this is what I was telling you about the parade before. Remember the last hour? Somebody called and said, you know, what should we do? But, you know, how do we get somebody elected? How do we keep the Democrats in line? It's not about that. It's about the parade. As Congress is creating a parade, the president is trying to get out in front of it. He also wants to keep, you know, scamming us. I mean, you know, the way that the administration, the executive, the president can do this. Well, here's a few examples that they have over at the Center for American Progress, has over at ThinkProgress.org. Well, the Education Department's budget is going to be cut under this Republican budget proposal. Bush proposed a 16% increase for teaching sexual abstinence in high schools, a popular cause for social conservatives. Representative Ann Northrup, the Republican from Kentucky, secured a $3.5 million research grant for a local surgical team. The funds came not from congressional earmarks, but from Pentagon accounts, according to the report. Bush requested $10 million for Preserve America grants for communities from the historic preservation efforts, and $50 million for the Helping America's Youth Initiative, also among programs championed by Mrs. Bush. These are all ways that basically he can spend money without Congress appropriating it. So he's talking about, he's opposed to pork, but the bottom line is, it's still going on. It's still going on. The economic royalists are here. I'm telling you, it is huge. Franklin Roosevelt, 1936, talking about these economic royalists have risen up. Whenever Tom from Minneapolis calls, as he did in the last hour, I always have to give you a little Franklin Roosevelt. It's just an old tradition here on the program.
But since that struggle
of 1776,
man's inventive genius released new forces in our land, forces which reordered the lives of our people. The age of machinery, of railroads, of steam and electricity, the telegraph and the radio, mass production, mass distribution, all of these combined to bring forward a new civilization, and with it a problem for those who sought to remain free.
And it's a serious problem. He's talking about the rise of corporate power, what he refers to as the new economic royalists. Franklin Roosevelt continues,
or out of this modern civilization. Economic royalists carved new dynasties. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things.
Now, when was the last time? I mean, can you even think of imagine a president talking like that. Saying, well, for example, here, Roosevelt again.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America.
Just like today.
Really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance.
And this is really the key to it, right here.
And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Requires the overthrow of this kind of power. I mean, can you imagine a president of the United States speaking like that today? The only guy I know out there actually who's even talking like that is John Edwards, but hopefully more will come, and they will if we create the parade. It used to be the law in America that corporations could not influence politicians. I mean, we're talking about the earmarks thing, the problem with Bush and the Republicans and $71 billion in pork. Consider this law that was on the books in Wisconsin for over 100 years. And it was this is typical. Every state in the Union had laws like this from the founding of this country until, depending on the state, the 1890s through the 1950s. This law was pulled off the books in 1954, as I recall. Political contributions by corporations. Keep in mind, this was the law of the land. Political contributions by corporations. No corporation doing business in this state shall pay or contribute or offer consent or agree to pay or contribute directly or indirectly any money, property, free service of its officers or employees or thing of value to any political party, organization, committee, or individual for any political purpose whatsoever, or for the purpose of influencing legislation of any kind, or to promote or defeat the candidacy of any person for nomination, appointment, or election to any political office. Penalty. Any officer, employee, agent, or attorney or other representative of any corporation acting for it in behalf of such corporation who shall violate this act shall be punished upon conviction by a fine of not less than $100 nor more than $5,000. And back in those days, that was a lot of money. Or by imprisonment in the state prison for a period of not less than one nor more than 5 years, or by both such fine and imprisonment in the discretion of the court or judge. And if a corporation, they shall be subject to a penalty of forfeiture in double the amount of any fine, and if a domestic corporation, it shall be dissolved. This is called the corporate death penalty. You get it? The corporate death penalty. This weekend, Saturday, this last Saturday, was the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. The Boston Tea Party was the uprising. It was when the United States, it was when we the people rose up against corporate power in America and said, no, enough. We're not going to take it anymore. It's over. The Boston Tea Party, the story of the Boston Tea Party is really an extraordinary one. People think the tea tax of 1773 was a tax increase. There's this widely held belief that it was a tax increase, and therefore the citizens of America stood up and said, no, we're not going to take any taxation without representation. In fact, the Tea Act of 1773, the thing that started the American Revolution, the thing that led directly to the Boston Tea Party, was a tax cut for the British East India Company. The British East India Company in 1773 was the Walmart of its day. And the people, the good citizens of Boston, and in Pittsburgh, in Philadelphia, they were ready to do the same thing. They just didn't have to because they stopped the ships from arriving. The same in New York Harbor. They were actually able to stop the ships from arriving pretty much everywhere else. When they came into Boston Harbor, they said, okay, that's it. We're going to trash this tea. That's it. We're over. It's done. It's toast. So the Tea Act of 1773, a corporate tax cut that triggered the American Revolution. And that Saturday, the anniversary of it, I'll share with you a little, just a short story about that after the break. And then we'll be taking your calls and talking about the news of the day. 16 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, filling in also for Al Franken all this week and next as he's doing his USO tour over in Iraq. And good on you, Al. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman is your gift from the Al Franken Show and Air America.
Tag your ears.
Isn't it great when somebody writes a song based on your own show theme? Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception, filling in for Al Franken also this week and next on Air America Radio. Oh, my. I just must. I just have to do it. The 1936, July of 1936, Franklin Roosevelt, his acceptance speech for his second term of office, this is how he wrapped that thing up. I shared a little clip with you earlier from it. Oh, and by the way, somebody called in and asked Lauren, the law, the Wisconsin law I was reading, where did I get that? It's in the endnotes in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And I got it from, I believe, as I recall, I wrote the book 6-7 years ago, so I'm operating from memory here, but I believe that I got it from the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, POCLAD. POCLAD.org would be their website. So anyhow, here Franklin Roosevelt wrapping up his talk on corporate power. And what happens when the conservatives, the corporatists, who are promoting the agenda of, well, the agenda is pretty transparent, are when you push back against them?
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
Now, does that sound at all familiar? I mean, you know, it's what Newt is doing, what George is doing.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
There you go. In their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Today, the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. I found when I was writing Unequal Protection, I tracked down a copy of the only book that has ever been published by somebody who was actually there at the Boston Tea Party. The guy's name was George Robert Twelve Tree Hughes. He was 17 years old at the time. And the book has been out of print since 1834. It was only in print for 1 year. Getting a copy of the book cost me about what the advance on the book paid me that I wrote from it. But it was so brilliant, and I wanted to have it. It's called A Retrospect of the Boston Tea Party with a Memoir by George R.T. Hughes, a survivor of the little band of patriots who drowned the tea in Boston Harbor in 1773. Published in New York by S.S. Bliss in 1834. And all of these guys had sworn a 50-year oath of silence because they were all committing a crime. I mean, this was like the first WTO riot. He starts out, he's talking about the Tea Act of 1773 rendered the smuggling of tea an object and was frequently practiced. Meanwhile, an immense quantity of it was accumulating in the warehouses of the East India Company of England. This company petitioned the king to suppress the duty of 3 pence per pound upon its introduction into America. You get that? It's like saying, you know, Walmart asked for tax break. The East India Company asked to suppress the duty of 3 pence per pound upon its introduction into America. That petition was successful and produced the Tea Act of 1773. As Hughes notes, the East India Company received permission to transport tea free of all duty from Great Britain to America, allowing it to wipe out its small competitors and take over the tea business in all of America. Hence, it was no longer the small vessels of private merchants who went to vend tea for their own account in the ports of the colonies, but, on the contrary, ships of an enormous burthen that transported immense quantities of this commodity, which, by the aid of the public authority, again, you know, the government's support, might, as they supposed, easily be landed and amassed in suitable magazines. The magazine was a warehouse. Accordingly, the company sent its agents in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia 600 chests of tea and a proportionate number to Charleston and other maritime cities of the American continent. The colonies were now arrived at the decisive moment when they must cast the die and determine their course. This was written, he wrote it in 1774, 1775. It was published 50 years later. Rusticus published a pamphlet called The Alarm. They were nailing this thing up on trees and houses around Boston. Are we in like manner to be given up to the disposal of the East India Company, who have now the assurance to step forth in aid to the minister to execute his plan of enslaving America? Their conduct in Asia for some years past has given simple proof how little they regard the laws of nations, the rights, liberties, or lives of men. 1,500,000, it is said, perished by famine in 1 year, not because the earth denied its fruits, but because this corporation and their servants engulfed all the necessities of life and set them at so high a price that the poor could not purchase them. That was, you know, one of the billboards of the day, or one of the flyers. That was the web of the day. That was the internet of its day. So after turning back the company's ships in Philadelphia and New York, Hughes writes, in Boston, the general voice declared, the time has come to face the storm. As The Alarm wrote on October 27, 1773, it hath now been proved to you that the East India Company obtained that monopoly of that trade by bribery and corruption. Thus the power they have prostituted to extortion and other the most cruel and horrible purposes the sun ever beheld. And thus began the American Revolution. Us saying no to essentially Walmart. 27 minutes past the hour.
Now more of the Al Franken Show with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
I like to drink clean water. I like to breathe clean air. I think that we should protect this precious earth we share. I care about the animals and the fishes in the sea. Clearly there is something wrong with me. I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
Oh. I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Yes, welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, we'd settle for a clean election. You know, we really would. Because if we had clean elections, then we'd have national health care. Then we'd have laws against corporations buying and selling politicians. We'd have progressive tax policies, and so on and so forth. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go over to TomHartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. This is the Tom Hartman program, also filling in this week and next for Al Franken, the Al Franken Show on Air America Radio. We're combining both, and Al Franken will be calling in from time to time as he tours around Iraq on his USO tour. He's in Iraq today. In fact, he called in the first hour of the program for those of you who are just calling in now. John, and so the show is being carried on by normal affiliates who've been carrying this program for 3.5 years, as well as all of Al's affiliates this week and next. Just, you know, so you know what's going on. And who is that man? That's me. John in North Hollywood, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to say that I have a hard time trusting a lot of this populist talk that you know, that I hear, because, you know, as you just pointed out, it was talked way back by FDR, and he was from the from this economic more elite background in this country, and we've lost it since, we had lost a bit of it since then, and what's to make me believe that we aren't just going to lose a lot of this populist ideology that you're discussing right now? Your radio station is financed by corporate, or at least economic, what I would call, you know, more elite. And I wish that you could put out your address so that I could give you a $20 donation so I could feel more responsible.
The way to support any kind of progressive programming is to support the sponsors, is to contact particularly the local sponsors, the ones that you hear on the local affiliates, and just say, hey, you know, I heard your ad, and either A, I'm going to buy your product, or B, I don't need to buy whatever it is you're selling, but if I know anybody who does, I'm going to recommend you to them. And thanks for supporting that kind of programming. I mean, that's pretty straightforward. And let the radio station know as well, but it's most important to let the sponsors know, because they're the ones that drive the process. This is, you know, a capitalist society. Capitalism is not a bad word. It's laissez-faire. It's unregulated capitalism that will destroy itself. It's what happened in the late 1920s. Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself. I mean, you know, when the Republican Great Depression happened, you had voices on the right, on the, you know, fascist voices. I mean, you know, people who were openly advocating fascism on one hand, and you had people openly advocating communism on the other hand, and they were both considered legitimate arguments, because this was, you know, pre-World War II. We hadn't seen the meltdown of the Soviet Union. We hadn't seen Stalin turn into a madman, and we hadn't seen what Hitler would do. And so it was all considered legitimate debate. And Roosevelt took us down a middle path and said, no, we're going to keep capitalism, but we're going to regulate it for the benefit of the people. We're going to make business subordinate to government. And I would submit to you that we have been through a series of cycles back and forth like this in the history of the United States, that arguably the founding of this country was a populist moment. The first populist time was from the 1760s, by and large, and arguably the 1750s, depending on when you start, you know, reading the, but certainly the 1760s, up until around the 1830s. When the Federalists imploded, and then the Whigs rose up, and then the Whig Party imploded, and in 1856 it was replaced by the Republican Party. But the implosion of the Federalists was the beginning of the rise. It was the beginning of the transformation of the Democratic Republican Party, what's now the Democratic Party, into a corporate party. And from the 1830s until the Civil War, we had, or until the election of Abe Lincoln, you had basically a corporatist regime in the country. And then Abe Lincoln came along as a reformer. I mean, the Republican Party was originally a reform party, a populist party. And so from Abe Lincoln until sometime in the 1880s, and different people put it in different times, I'd say probably around 1885, 1886, sometime in the 1880s, you had a populist regime. And then in the 1880s, with the rise of the robber barons, the Gilded Age, we went back to a corporatist age. And that went on until 1901. Teddy Roosevelt becomes president when McKinley's assassinated in 1901, and he suddenly says, wait a minute, we're going to go back to being populists. And the trust buster, he starts busting up corporations. That lasted from 1901 to arguably the end of the Woodrow Wilson administration, 1921. And then from 1922, with the election of, what was it, Harding or Coolidge, whoever it was, I forget my order of those Republicans in that era there after World War One, but basically from then until the Republican Great Depression and the end of the Hoover administration in 1932, we had a corporatist regime again. And laissez-faire economics. And again, you saw the middle class get wiped out. The middle class that had sort of come back under Teddy Roosevelt got wiped out again. The middle class was wiped out during the robber baron era from the 1880s to 1901. In 1900, the year that, you know, the year before Teddy Roosevelt became president, 1900, average income in the United States in today's dollars was $9,700 a year. People were poor in this country. It was what you get when you have an unregulated economy. A small, very powerful, wealthy class and a small middle class, which are mostly mercantilists, people who are shop owners and specialists, and a very large class of the working poor. And so, anyhow, Franklin Roosevelt essentially created the middle class. He said, okay, we're gonna create a middle class with the Wagner Act of 1935, unionization, with Social Security, so that the leading cause of death among old elderly people would no longer be hypothermia in the winter and starvation in the summer. I mean, these are major transformations in America. And that populist era that you're asking about really lasted until 1981. I mean, you had Dwight Eisenhower, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican president, advocating for a 90% top income tax rate, for, in favor of progressive income tax. During the Eisenhower administration, you had corporations paying anywhere from 30 to 35% of the total tax load in this country. Now it's less than 10%. And yet they use arguably half of the commons, you know, public education, our roads, the court system, the whole infrastructure of America, and on it goes. And then Reagan came in 1980, and he flipped us corporatists. And we have been that way ever since. Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush, it's all been corporatist. So the period from 1921 to 1932 has been like this period now. And the question is not, you know, is the populist rhetoric going to go away? The question is, are the populists going to end up winning? And that's going to be decided in all probability in 2 years in the election of 2008. And it's not going to happen as the result of us electing the right person. It's going to happen as the result of us speaking out and those people in power changing their minds. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Sharon, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I have a couple questions about the free trade stuff and Clinton and Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you talked about Clinton and the free trade things. I've had my questions about Hillary, and I'm just wondering, what does Bill Clinton think now of what he did with the free trade agreements? And is Hillary going to be of the same mind that he was?
Well, I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to either of those questions, Sharon. When I introduced Bill Clinton in Seattle, what was it, about 5-6 months ago, I was up there. The radio station talked to 90 up there, and we had Jim McDermott and Bill Clinton, and I did the MC thing. And I spoke with him backstage, but I was tempted to talk politics, but I just didn't. I plead whatever. It was a crazy night. I don't know where he stands on the issue right now, and I haven't heard him talk about it. With regard to Hillary, I think that, you know, her position right now, by and large, is pro-free trade. But my point is that even if she were to be elected president, even if she were running for president, and was holding that position, if enough of us spoke out, I believe that she would change her position, and hopefully that he would, too. The point is, This is such a big point, Sharon, is that it's not the politician. It's what we the people are pushing for, because eventually the politicians will come along with us. I mean, you know, look at segregation. Look at the civil rights movement. Look at women's rights movement. The list goes on and on and on. If we create the pressure from the bottom up, the politicians will come along. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay,
thank you very
great.
Much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Tomas.
You know, I think you might want to think about playing that Backman Turner Overdrive song, Working Overtime, with your double duty you're doing there.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I can fill in for somebody else at the same time I'm doing my normal show. So thanks for listening to us on WTKG there. What's up?
This is one of the best shows I've ever heard. Matter of fact, I'm going to say something that I never thought I would say to a liberal, but
for our listeners, by the way, I should let everybody know, Tomas, you're a Republican conservative who's been calling this program for 2 years or longer. So go ahead.
But I just like to know, can I get screwed by Tom Hartman?
Yeah, you can buy the book at the bookstore.
All right.
And I think you'll like it, actually. I know that you consider yourself a conservative, but the book is foundationally about the history of America and how, you know, how economically we're being screwed. And it's, Tomas, thanks. Go ahead.
All right. I'd just like to know if you can make a connection between the East India Company and the Walmart China Company, because...
That was my point. I think that it's pretty much the same thing, and it's time for another Boston Tea Party. Tomas, thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fixed elections and justice strikes from all directions. People with their backs against the floor, looking for someone to set us free. A king with fists like Muhammad Ali. The holidays are here and we're still at war.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, coming up thereon in the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Program, also filling in for the Al Franken Show all this week. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Cindy in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Cindy, yeah. Thanks for waiting so long. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. First, thanks to Louise for the music. That last song, Holidays Are Coming and We're Still at War, strikes right at the heart.
Yeah, indeed. And she's sitting right here and she's smiling.
Thanks. Yeah.
You're welcome back at you, Cindy.
Okay. I wanted to call and mention to you, I think I've spotted a new parade that might be worth you talking about some more in the future. Have you heard of the Blue Tiger Democrats?
Not enough to be able to speak intelligently about them. I've heard
okay.
the phrase.
Well, I'm kind of excited about it. My parents grew up in Oklahoma during the Depression era, and at that time they were Democrat. And because everybody was Democratic, because what the Democratic Party did was it helped people solve problems. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't have school clothes to start school, they would help you find a family that had hand-me-downs. And if you needed a job or if you needed help with housing, they helped people solve problems. And the Blue Tiger Democrats have gotten started in New York, where they're helping veterans. They've gotten moving in Michigan, where they've held workshops to help about 65,000 low-income people afford heat during the winter, and also in Arizona, where they're working with senior citizens. And the whole idea is to, as Democrats, you know, roll up our sleeves and help government work. If the complaint from the Republicans is government doesn't work, well, we'll demonstrate that it does work and that civic participation matters.
Well, you know, where this whole thing began was, first of all, was with Reagan coming along and saying,
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And he created that whole mindset that government is evil. And then the reason for this, of course, is that the conservatives want corporations to basically control everything. They want a small corporate elite to run the whole show. And so you get folks like Limbaugh saying,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
So, you know, ending union protection, ending Social Security, ending Medicare, ending unemployment insurance, ending workplace protection. Just the list goes on and on and on. That's their agenda. That's what they're all about. And I think it's great that there's a group of Democrats who are saying, let's get back to the roots of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and one of the things I thought you'd also appreciate, just because I know you're interested in the symbolism of American history, is that the tiger is coming from Chief Tammenend of New York, who recommended the tiger as mascot to the Democratic Party long, long before the donkey was associated with Jackson. And it really is wonderful because the tiger was even still common association for people during FDR's time.
Oh, interesting.
And it
But if it's before Jackson, you mean back during the time when Thomas Jefferson was still alive?
Yes.
The guy who invented the Democratic Party.
Yes. Way back to the Democrat Republicans.
Yeah.
And so the connection of the tiger to civic engagement is really amazing. And I think this is a parade that could get people connecting.
Well, that's a great one. That's a great one. Cindy, I'm going to have to look for that. Thank you so much for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. And I will keep my eyes open. Millie in Massachusetts. Hey, Millie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Two things quickly. Mm-hmm. On the Tim and Tom show,
You're talking about Tim Russert and Tom Friedman?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Tim is either intimidated by the administration or he believes them, both of which is awful. Tom was so insulting, he held his nose and pulled his hand down and said, most Democrats did this when they voted for Gore and Kerry. Last time I looked, Gore got over 500,000 more votes than Bush, so what were the Republicans holding?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know Al Franken.
That's votes that we know of.
Oh, that's right.
Let's not talk about the people who tried to vote, but we're told, sorry, you can't vote because voting while black is against the law.
I mean, how insulting to say they just did it because they didn't have anyone else. And then what is the as I call them, Precious in the White House doing?
Yes. Yeah.
One other thing, Al Franken. Plays a clip once in a while, and I wish someone would play it every time Bill Kristol talks. Before the Iraq War, he ridiculed people who thought that the Shia and the Sunnis wouldn't get along. He said there was no evidence of that. What history books has he been reading? Yeah. Why do people still listen to him?
to Crystal Well, because he's representing the power elite. I mean, that's the bottom line. He's representing the interests that also own the big networks. Thank you for the call, Millie. Doug in Staten Island. Hey, Doug, we got to wrap up the show here in just a few seconds. What's up?
Quite all right, Tom. It's a pleasure to listen to you. You know, I just wanted to say thank you for listening to your program. You know, the point that you bring out, that this has always been a chase through history of constant forces conflicting with each other. You have Jefferson, who talked about the selfish spirit of commerce, knowing no country and feeling no passion or principle but that of gain. Yeah, I mean,
well, Jefferson actually was on both sides of pretty much every issue at one point or another in his life. I mean, that's the problem with trying to collect the founders.
Yeah, that is true. Well, anyway, listen, I just thought there's not enough time in the program, but people should remember that back in the 30s, Smedley Darlington Butler, he was the commander of the Marine Corps.
Yeah, he wrote War is a Racket.
Yeah, right. He's a double Medal of Honor winner. He's still the most highest decorated to this day.
And he testified General before officer. Congress that J.P. Morgan, that a bunch of industrialists had tried to hire him
Goodyear,
to overthrow FDR.
Firestone, etc.
Yep.
And listen, this is just for yourself. FDR, April 1938, he said, quote, "The liberty of democracy is not safe if we tolerate the growth of private power to the point where it is stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism."
You're right. Yeah, well said, Doug. Thank you very much for the call. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be debating conservative Yaron Brook, about universal health care. That and more in your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, also filling in for Al Franken. Remember, my friends, never forget, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Take good care.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.